My name is Stephanie Johnson. My daughter, Anne Christine Johnson, was brutally murdered by her ex-husband, Sean Hardy, in his father's house. Why Did She Stay focuses solely on sharing the stories of abused women in the hope that you will be able to walk a mile in their shoes. You will learn what it's like to come home to a closed fist, this Holocaust against women. Statistically, 1 in 4 women is being physically abused by their intimate partners. These are their stories. And as always, if you are that 1 in 4, immediately reach out to your community's domestic shelter for help. Your life could depend upon it. Hashtag reasons to leave.
Hi, my name is Ronnie Keller. I'm 36. Today's date is March 12th, 2019. I am in Houston. We are at Bo's Place, and I am here with a friend, Stephanie, who I know as my friend's mother, my friend who passed away from domestic violence.
My name is Stephanie Johnson. I'm 60 years old. Today's date is March 12th, 2019. We're in Houston, Texas at Bo's Place, and I'm talking to my daughter's best friend.
Tell us about Anne and how we lost her.
This sounds like a cliche mother thing to say, but she was one of the most beautiful people that anyone said they had ever met. She was witty and eloquent. Despite her looks and charm, she was very humble and treated everybody as though they were the same. And all of this came to an end about seven years ago when she met the man who eventually killed her. You and I became close after she went missing, and we buddied up to get the police to launch an investigation. And through the subsequent horror of all the, not just criminal trial, but the family trial in the fight to get her child. So I would like to add that in life, my daughter would have been horrified that you and I are talking about her in such an intimate fashion.
Right. She would. She would hate this. I'm okay with that, though, because I kind of feel like she brought it on herself to have us here together.
Yes, in a very twisted and sad way.
She just listened to us. We could have. How does it... It feels like this recording is mainly about grief, but I feel like it's a bit unfair to you because I don't feel like you've had the proper grieving abilities. It's almost like you're on pause.
I think I'm frozen because, as you know, she was murdered on December 8th, but we didn't find out she was missing until 3 or 4 days later. As I've said publicly many times, the police in League City were corrupt and favored the man who murdered her, and they weren't going to do anything to launch an investigation until you and I breezed into their office down there the day after we found that they were missing. They launched a token search, and since I'm in media relations, I threatened them that I would go to the press. Of course, nobody really cared because it really wasn't a news story at that time, and I looked like an aggrieved, panic-stricken mother. One of the reporters I talked to urged me to go to Texas Equisearch, and Texas Equisearch immediately jumped in and took over. So from there, we went into a 3-week search. She was finally found on December 30. Even then, there was no time to pause because we went into the criminal proceedings, the bail bond reduction hearing, the fight to see my grandson. And since then, it's just been nonstop legal. And I've given many interviews to the media and conversations with lawyers, and I've felt that if I stop to really feel it and process it, there won't be much left of me. So we're facing the criminal trial in July and probably a family trial in December. I had hoped that by coming to Bo's Place, I would crack, but yeah. I still haven't broken down and convulsively sobbed.
Has there been a long enough period of time where you haven't had to deal with attorneys or reporters that, like, just space for yourself to kind of deal with the fact that she's gone?
After she went missing, I would sit and I would say her name, Anne Christine. And I would see how long I could say Anne Christine, Anne Christine, Anne Christine until I started crying. But no, because every single day I would get up and I go online and I check the daily dockets to see if there's been any criminal activity or activity on the criminal case. And then after that, I check the email, and invariably there's an email regarding one of the cases. So the answer is sort of maybe, but really no.
Yeah. If Anne Christine could see us now and see the fact that Sean is still out, like, what do you think her ghost would want to tell you?
I don't know, because as you know, this was a domestic violence murder, and he was pretty much inside her head, otherwise she would have left. I don't know what she would say. I was asked a lot by reporters, like, what would she say or tell me something about her? She was probably about 100 IQ points smarter than I am, but she was like the genuine thing. She was a real artist. I think she probably would have forgiven Sean. But I also think she would be very concerned about her son, Roland, because ultimately, as many people know, she stayed in the relationship to protect Roland. Mm-hmm. And to keep him safe. So she, in many ways, sacrificed herself for her son.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, because of Julian, one of the reasons that Julian was with us at the time of the murder was because it wasn't safe for him to be down there in League City, and I live in Northwest Houston.
Before that period of where you kind of had to pull Julian out of that atmosphere, when you were still able to hang around with Julian and Roland and Anne in the limited capacity that you were, like, what was the dynamic towards the end there between Julian and Roland and you and ACJ?
We couldn't go to her apartment because it wasn't safe. I didn't trust that Sean wouldn't be lurking, or when we had been around him, the conversation was very stilted, and we were all walking on eggshells. Julian has since shared with me abusive things that he did at the time that I wasn't aware of. But once Sean was out of the equation, it was just natural, and we had a lot of fun, and we went shopping, and we sat in restaurants. Julian was like a silly little besotted child around his mommy. He would stare at her and laugh at everything she said, and they would do art. But the problem with being in these public places, obviously, is that Roland's autistic. Mm-hmm. And at that time, he was, what, 3 years, 4 years old? 5 years old, sorry. It's all a blur. So he was prone to meltdowns, and we had to be very careful about what might set him off. And I think Julian resented that to a certain extent, because right. He did have limited time with his mom.
What's the most common question Julian asks you now when y'all hang around?
After she was murdered, this wasn't my choice, but certain individuals decided not to tell him what happened, even though I knew that he knew, because this was all over the news and his mm-hmm. school friends' mothers talked. And they were telling him she was murdered, but I was under a gag order. So Julian didn't ask me questions about that. We would start talking about his mommy and how much they like to do art together, and I would try to explained to him that she really loved him, but she was down in Lake City taking care of Roland and protecting him. And gradually the conversations morphed over time to be a little bit more in a circuitous fashion, focused on his loss and his grief. And one of the things I do, which is maybe wrong, is try to keep her alive to him. I say things like, your mom would have loved that. Mm-hmm. Or your mom would be so impressed that you draw so well. Did you know your mom was pretty? We go, which is, you know, obviously a superficial thing, but I know he looked at her like she was a goddess. One of the things we do is go out to her grave. And I say, Julian, if your mom was here, like, what would you want her to know about yourself? And he gives me that look on his, he's got that look on his face, which is identical to hers, which basically says, like, you think I'm going to tell you that?
That's my secret. So when Anne was younger, I think this was sparked from a conversation we were having earlier. You know how when daughters bond with their mothers, it's usually like they pry into your like things that happened to you. What was the most common story that Anne would try to pry from you growing up?
She would pry from me, or I would pry from her?
That she would ask you.
I'm sure she loved me, but she really didn't care. She was, and she heard me yak to my friends all the time, so there probably wasn't anything she didn't know. She might ask me when we were going to go do something or what we were going to buy.
There was never any part of your past that you didn't share with her because the opportunity just never arose? Or
no, we had all kinds of discussions because obviously those who know me understand that my marriage ended in a bloody divorce. And so we would talk about things that kind of led up to that, and I would try to make her understand things about the past that I felt had impacted her as a child, not so much, but, you know, when she was a teenager.
Do you think she received it, or do you think she just kind of didn't understand where you were coming from?
I think she wished I would stop talking about myself. I do know that when you're talking to your child, it's best to keep the conversation focused on them.
When you went through that divorce, was there a period of time where Anne didn't live with you?
Yes. When we got divorced, or when the divorce was in process, we lived in Canada, and I hadn't been working. When we came back to the States, I had brain surgery. I guess we were still in Canada. I came back here for treatment. And the brain surgery was catastrophic from in terms of my ability to have a job and function. And I also honestly believe that I couldn't take care of my kids emotionally, because I learned later this can be an outcome of brain surgery, but I was extremely depressed and not functional. And her father was very stable and had a good job, and I felt it was better for her to be with him. I know from post-mortem, posthumously, reading all of her journals, which would have upset her, greatly upset me, that she thought that was the biggest mistake I ever made in my entire life, that she should have been with me, and she felt as though I had rejected her. And I think about that a lot, because I'm always looking for the point that set her on the trajectory towards domestic violence, and how she was able to get sucked up into the worldview of an abuser.
In reading her journals, was there ever any mention on her part, an understanding that maybe the situation you were in was completely out of your control?
The journals, I think that her abuser, I'll stop using his name, her abuser probably threw out a lot of the journals because she wrote everything down, and I don't doubt that they chronicled a lot of that. Oh, and in the journals, there were like angry, angsty teenage journals and early teen journals. And I think she was mad, pretty much.
The way that she felt, do you think your sons felt the same way? That you left them? That you could have opted not to?
Courtney may have heard this, but there's a Dylan Thomas quote that I think about a lot. And the quote is that after the first death, there is no other. Meaning once you've had the mortal blow, everything else is kind of just subsequent to that, although it might be more horrific. I think for all of them, losing their mother was a terrible thing. And since we're talking about loss, I would say that Anne Christine was the only child that remembered what it was like before, when we had our bucolic existence, where there was nothing more urgent than deciding which hamburger to order at the country club. We had a very pampered life.
What a horrible upbringing.
I know. I know she blamed me her entire life now.
If you think Anne could communicate to her sister and her brothers now, what do you think she would want to tell them?
I am not the kind that really focuses on the afterlife. I don't walk around looking for spiritual signs that she's still alive. But my daughter-in-law, Najia, is from Azerbaijan. Najia has told them all that she's appeared to her in dreams, that sometimes she thinks she can hear her or see her. And this is a gift that's been in their family. So I think that they found that very comforting. Najia's told them that she's still around and she will pass on. She's kind of making sure that we're okay, and that's comforting to them. We were having dinner at Najia's new condo, and we started talking about Sean and the murder, and I'll be God, D-A-M-N, if the light above the kitchen table didn't start flickering. And so we stopped for a minute, and Laja said, "Say his name." And I did, and it flickered. I think that her sister Molly lost her best friend. Mm-hmm. And I really don't know how that's impacted her, because she hasn't spoken to me about that. And Christine, because of the divorce, really protected Molly. And
mm-hmm. How long after the divorce did Ann move back in with you?
It was back and forth, mostly.
Was it with the siblings, or was it just her?
It was mostly just her, because she was older, and I could leave her if I needed to work. But I tried to keep the kids together, because I thought that was the most important thing, because they'd lost so much already. And again, when I think about what happened to her, usually I start with where did it go wrong from the first time that she kicked in the womb. And then I lead up to that point in time, like, what set her up for ultimately sacrificing herself? When people ask me to describe her, one of the things I always say is, well, when I was pregnant with her, she used to kick me in the ribs. And when I would push her little heel down, she would kick again, only harder.
You can't silence
so
me.
One could say we had a problematic mother-daughter relationship that started before she was born.
But her bond and your bond was probably the strongest.
Yes,
all her siblings.
And I hate to rely on other great works of literature to describe my own situation, but one of the movies she saw was Terms of Endearment.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yes, and Aurora, the mother, you know, falls into the baby bed, making sure she's still breathing, and is a big thorn in her daughter's side throughout her entire life. But towards the end, it was the relationship with Aurora. And I sometimes cry, because there's a scene in one of the subsequent Larry McMurtry books where Aurora's dying on her deathbed, and she's drifting in and out of consciousness. And, of course, they're all looking to see if she's breathing. And she comes back at one point, and they said, "Where were you?" And she says, "Someplace where I had a daughter." I know that makes us both tear up. So that's where I hope to be someday again, where I have a daughter.
Did you introduce Aunt Christine to C.W. Lewis, or is that some...
C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis, I'm sorry.
Because of the divorce, I put her in therapy to try to help her make sense of things when she was 12, and her therapist in Amarillo, where we were living at the time, introduced her to the book Till We Have Faces, which is a retelling of a Greek myth. I never read the book until after she died, because I felt somehow that would be an intrusion into her life, because she carried that book with her everywhere. And in fact, one of the last times she stayed with me before she died, when I was able to get her out briefly, she left that copy there, and I found it after the funeral. And the book, towards the end, is about the fact that you really can't see God until you can show him your true face, that has no ego, that is who you are. And I believe that's why it's called Till We Have Faces. And I would like to think that she was showing her true face and saw God towards the end. She wasn't a religious person. Her murder was very brutal. And as we all know, he gave three confessions. And the third confession was the one in which he told the police what really happened, which is why we know that confession's been tossed by the judge as being inadmissible because of the way it was obtained. And as you know, but I'll say it for the record, there was probably a fight. She'd been on, and what I didn't know before she was murdered was how insidious the violence was. In my mother frame of denial mind, I thought that, you know, he would get mad and they'd have a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be it.
Like slamming doors, walking
Yeah, and then that would,
away.
Like, go away. But it wasn't the way it was. She was brutalized every day, and I didn't know this. But the night he killed her, she'd been on social media kind of joking around. I also know now he controlled her social media. But at some point, there must have been an argument, and he told the police that he shoved her to the ground so hard that she was bleeding from her nose and her ears. Then He stabbed her through the heart with a knife.
Or he kicked the knife.
Yes, he said he kicked the knife. He's a skinhead, and he later showed the police the dent in his work boots, conveniently and helpfully. Mm-hmm. And then after that, she gurgled. So he wanted to put her out of her misery, so he suffocated her with a plastic bag, a Kroger's bag, which was ironic because she loved Kroger's because...
She made a post on how much she loved Kroger's.
They were so kind to her autistic son. Mm-hmm. So to this day, I can barely hold a knife, and I always ask for paper at the grocery store. They say that your last thought when you're in the trenches is of your mother. But I really hope that her last thought was...
Free.
I'm free. I saw, you know, I'm seeing God.
Yeah. When did you first feel like you started to lose her? Because it wasn't when she disappeared that I think we felt.
No, her first marriage was to a really nice guy and the father of her first son, Julian. And I was always sticking my nose there where it didn't belong. But I knew that if I was politely invited to leave, everything was just the way it was supposed to be, a la Aurora in terms of endearment. But like Aurora, when Sean came along, I knew there was something off. At first, she was madly in love, and he could do no wrong. And then when I met him, I thought he was a little bit too charming and over the top. She got pregnant immediately, and my first glimmer of horror was when we were in the ICU with Roland, who was born at 27 weeks. And he told me to take my hand off the isolette. And at that point, I began to closely pay attention, and our relationship did change.
That was the first red flag from your point of view.
Yes, and I guess when I think about the grief process, I started losing my daughter at that point.
Did you ever tell Aunt Christine about that incident in the hospital?
Yes.
And what was her reaction to that?
Like a lot of abused women, I think she made excuses for him. All right, Sean's just that way, or Mom, you know, this, that, or the other.
Or maybe you just imagined it.
Exactly, because I think when you're in those situations where everything is life and death, you don't want to precipitate something. I think you also get sucked in to the abuser's world, the fabulous world of F-A-B-U-L-I-S-T, of, well, maybe this, maybe not. You get sucked into that, too. I didn't realize how bad things were until he poisoned her and put her in the hospital. And then subsequent to that, she was tortured and strangled for 3 hours. And when I got to the intensive care unit, there were bruises all over her neck. And that's when I knew that this was going to be the most important battle of my life and hers.
How long was that time frame from before she had gone missing to when, or I guess, when you started to notice these red flags and you started to come to terms that, okay, she is in a domestic violence relationship. Like, how long was that time span?
Wait, starting when again?
Like, when you first realized that Aunt Christine was in this relationship to when she actually went missing. How long was that time span?
I think I found out later that he was abusing her right after the baby was born, which is pretty frightening.
Because that's a long time.
So, yes, I think I knew that at least verbal was going on and some physical. She began to become very skittish. To put it bluntly, I'm not known for my housekeeping skills, and she was rather artsy and didn't care too much if the car had 3 feet of, you know, McDonald's wrappers and coffee cups on the ground.
Empty cups, and yeah.
But that changed. He moved her to the Bolivar Peninsula, which was very isolating. And so I would drive down there, and she would be by herself with her son. And then he would show up unexpectedly, because that's what he did. And she would kind of nervously move throughout the kitchen, cleaning and dusting. And I just thought, oh, my God, how are we going to get her out of this? Which, you know, because she called you, too. I would bring her money because I don't know where his money went, but there was never food. I would bring cat food because the cat was starving. She had no money.
It was a terrible cycle.
I would buy
cycle.
Her cigarettes because she liked to smoke. And
it's a terrible, terrible cycle to be
sometimes
in.
Sometimes I would bring a bottle of wine just because I thought, maybe if she has a drink, she'll start to tell me more.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's when the loss was gradual and incremental. So by the time she went missing, I was pretty numb. She died in December, and at the end of October, I found out from someone that he had been pushing her to the ground and beating her, but that she'd managed to survive the assault, and I went nuts. I sent a letter, an email, because I wanted everything in writing. Having learned that in my divorce, I sent an email to his father, who is a wealthy businessman, and begged him to get her out of the house. I left messages on Facebook with all of her friends saying, for God's sake, if she calls you, get her. Don't ask a question. Don't pass any judgment. Just go get her.
It's not that easy.
And I know. Well, now I know. I texted her and said, look, I'd already been doing this. I'd been asking the police to do welfare checks. But I said, I'm going to do welfare checks. I'm going to park my car outside your house at night. I'm going to be up Sean's ASS. I want to know that you're as safe as you can be until I get you out of there. And I learned later that was exactly the wrong thing to do. I also didn't understand that he was monitoring her phone calls and her social media. And people said, oh my God, you've probably escalated him to the next level. It made it much harder for her. At which point, to my everlasting regret, guilt, and continued grief process, among my last words to her were like, fine, just get yourself killed. I was so fed up and I was angry that I actually said that to her. And that's one of the things I have to live with. I think my other last words to her were on text, for God's sakes, why aren't you answering my text? I have Julian, we have Julian for Christmas, and I just need to know, because if you know you're going to be with Sean, I don't think Julian needs to be with his grandma. He needs to be someplace with his siblings, his stepbrothers.
Right.
And after that, I never heard from her again.
It's kind of a no-win situation. Either you butt in and try to help, or you ignore it completely. Neither one is a winner.
That's what... I never offer anyone advice on domestic violence, because obviously...
Because I took the route of wanting to help her. I didn't do the welfare checks. I would do what I was accustomed to doing, just because this is what you grow up with. You know, I don't reach out. I wait for you to reach out to me so I know it's safe for me to talk to you. But that also didn't work. So.
No, it was like, a lot of people in my grief support groups, they lost kids suddenly and tragically. Some of them did lose their kids to things like cancer, so they knew it was coming. But for me, she began dying. Mm-hmm. When she met Sean, it was like a slow, gradual, horrible death that we couldn't stop. And I know I see you tear up.
Hey, look, I can cry again.
I think I'm going to stay dissociative, as my therapist has pointed out. One time, one of my dogs killed one of her cats, and I never told her because I just thought it was easier for her to think the cat ran off. But when I saw the little pieces of that cat lying around the garden, I thought there was the most beautiful of creatures just reduced to this, to little bits of flesh and bone. And as we know, after he murdered her so heinously, he dragged her body out through his fence and took her outdoors, and when Equisearch brought her back in, or excuse me, when Equisearch began its investigation, I think it spooked him because he brought her body back into the house. I don't know this for a fact, but I have heard through sources that he started pouring chemicals and cleaners over her to mask the odor and maybe
probably try to disintegrate
the body. And then he wrapped her in a plastic bag, and when she was discovered, she was surrounded by scented candles. So to your earlier question, I think I've had to stay numb, because how do you process something like that? She was like the cat, this beautiful creature who in life embodied everything most people would like to look like, and she was chic. And there she was, obviously, I never saw her again. Her body went off to the coroner. And then I wanted to have the guts that Emmett Till's mother had.
The open casket?
Yeah, the open casket, so that people could see what had happened to her, to him. And then I thought, no, what good would that do? Any of us, especially not her son. So we had her cremated. I never saw her again. But she was found in her Christmas pajamas. And so I have to process not the death, but all of these details that should make me cry and scream and pull my hair out, but it's had the opposite effect. It's just closed me down.
As soon as this trial is over, regardless of what route it happens to go, I'm gonna assume numbnuts will get off. But do you feel like there's gonna be any progress in your grieving, or do you think your life is just gonna stay stuck?
Not stuck, because I have to go on. I've watched all the cliched movies, read all of the cliched books about how you have to go on and make a life for yourself and perhaps find meaning. And I don't know. I don't know if it's possible for me to do that. I do look at Tim Miller, who founded EquiSearch after his daughter was murdered. I look at other people who've gone on to do things. But in my case, after the criminal trial's over, I'll be in civil court before a jury, trying to at least get a visitation with her son. And every time I see her son, it's like looking at her. So I hope so, because I don't want to spend the rest of my life like Mrs. Havisham, frozen and looking at the wedding dress in the closet. I have her shoes, those hideous high heels that I hated so much that she wore everywhere. Sitting on my mantle, I have her ashes, part of her ashes with me, that her ex-husband wanted me to keep apart, which will go back into the grave after this is over, and I no longer take them to court. So some people I know refer to my house as the shrine, with pictures and journals, and I really hope that I'm able to turn it back into my house again, in a place where Julian and Roland feel like it's grandma's house, and that every other bit of our conversation isn't, "Your mommy would have loved that," or "Your mom loved crawfish. It was her birthday on March 2nd, and Julian wanted to go have crawfish, and he pretended that he liked them." and he sat there, like, trying to peel them and going, So my grandmother self said, "That's okay, I'll help you eat some of those." And I think I pretended I was crying from the spice, not the fact that what's left of her is his concept of trying to be close to her by eating crawfish.
It'll be nice to see Roland and Julian together.
I know, but one of the cruel things about all this is that Sean's family is trying to take Roland away from us. And I know that Roland witnessed the murder, and he's highly traumatized. And we've had to fight just to see him. And I suppose her enduring legacy will be these two little boys who need each other and can't be with each other until I fight another court battle. And then I would just like to be able to look at Julian's pouty face, which is exactly like her face, and not think, "Oh, you look just like your mother," and just think, you know, here's two little kids that need their own life, and then we need to make it as happy for them as we possibly can. I would just like to say, for the record, since you're like running out of wind, that you've been the best thing ever. We're like an improbable twosome.
It is weird that I can only really open up that grieving part to you. It's really hard to talk about it.
I know, and I've started hammering you since she's dead and I can't annoy her. I'm like, "Ronnie, when are you going to law school? Ronnie this, Ronnie that. Ronnie, let's have a glass of wine." Yeah. But you've been, I don't know, From a practical standpoint, you go to court with me, you explain the law, you can follow the complicated legal maneuvering and motion this, motion.
It just sucks because I feel like when you look at it from a legal perspective, you really don't get to see anybody as human anymore.
No, and I think she's an afterthought to the DA and to the police because everybody wants that perfect victim.
Right.
If she'd been a soccer mom like I was sitting home, I mean, but no, she was complicated. She was forced to continue to wait tables and serve drinks because it was the only way she could stay employed and stay close to Roland. The divorce that he had forced her into without going into a lengthy process did not favor her, and so she was doing everything she could.
It's a common abuser's use of the court systems.
Yeah, but no offense, Ronnie, I would rather not know you on such a close personal level because
no, I mean, I get
you were still
it.
Her
agree.
Best friend. Like, you know, we aren't comrades in arm. But yeah, it's one of the horrible outcomes of death are the way life goes on without the dead person and things that you never thought possible start to happen, like all of the many friendships I now have with her friends and with others.
She did have a big support network.
Oh, everybody loved her.
That's what was so puzzling. In domestic violence, I think it's so common for the abuser to cut everybody out of their lives.
He did a great job.
He did.
In many ways, her death predates her actual death. Mm-hmm. I sit around and I think, did she know she was going to die? When did she know she was going to die? At what point did she know she wasn't going to get out of it? At what point? I just pray to God that she was so stunned when he threw her to the ground that everything else was just a haze to her. But when I heard that she started gurgling, I became obsessed. My psychiatrist put me on some medication because I used to sit around and say, what did her eyes look like when she died? I sit around and I check my dogs every morning to make sure they're breathing. I check Joe to make sure he's still breathing. I look on Facebook to see if my kids are still...
Where do you think you would be if Joe wasn't with you?
I don't know. One of the things for a grieving person is having others around who are stable and consistent, because grief takes you to a childlike basis, because that face in C.S. Lewis is Till We Have Faces. You get one of those faces too. You're just stripped of all pretense and artifice and any desire to pretend anything. You know, her high school class gave me a book of quotes from C.S. Lewis, and I like to flip through like I'm flipping through the Bible and find something inspirational. And one of them was, I shared it with my grief group, one of them was something to the effect that experience is a brutal teacher, and boy, will you learn from experience. What's your quote, Ronnie?
So you can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start where you are and change the ending. I really like that from a domestic violence standpoint, because I feel like in Anne's situation, if we could have caught it in time.
Oh, I know. But and I refer to that as the point of inflection, and I think a lot of people do that, have lost somebody. Well, where could I have started? I know one of my friends lost a son to drowning, and she's the same thing. Well, should I have gotten up? Should I have gotten a different side of bed? Should I have called him? So I don't know. I mean, I don't know. To me, it is an ending, but it should be a beginning.